Before I start, are any questions? I was going to dive into the microcausality. Yeah.
Okay, I don't know if this is a good time to ask that, but okay, we've seen that. So basically, when you do the group argument,
yeah,
you can show that in the massive case, you have like the 2j plus 1 the spin states.
Yeah.
And then when you do the massless case, you have like, you can show that the little groups of the or finite dimensional on the labels that are not momentum, you're forced to have only rotations, not the boost.
You're not forced. There's a in both cases, there's a three-parameter subgroup.
Okay.
But in the massless case, it's not just rotations. It's a two-parameter family of boosts and a one-dimensional rotation.
Yeah.
And so then so you can figure out what the representations are. But what you see is that if you do the rotation away from the preferred, you know, the photon direction, and when you rotate those the labels of those things, they rotate. So if you have any non-zero label for them, you get a continuous family of them. And so if you're using those to label the states, that means that for a given momentum, you've got an infinite number of, you've got some label which is not discrete. And so you've got an infinite number of states at a given momentum for a one particle. And so and people, every 20 years, people think, well, maybe that's telling us something. But the standard particle representations are the ones where that rotation is represented by the unit matrix. And so then all you have left is this one rotation. But there's nothing in it. The only argument for throwing these things away is that your representations would be, you know, continuously infinite.
No, I mean that's fine, but like where I was going with that is that if you have like 2D rotations, that implies, since it's a one-dimensional V group, that implies like only one spin state. And then I read that you can get the other spin state, because there's two spin states as we know. You can get the other one by parity transformation.
Right. Right.
So why doesn't the same argument in the massive case generate more than the 2g plus 1? Because like the 2g plus 1 are just like the, you know. Like
because what's happening in the massless case is that it is true that the labels, the third component of angular momentum does change sign, but you already had it. So that the rotations. So in that case, parity. One way to think about that is that parity, which is a reflection, is also like a rotation through 180 degrees, and so. So since you've already represented the 180 degree rotation, parity is just one of those. It's acting within the states you already had. But in the case of massless particles, it could not be the same state because it had to change sign. Unless it had zero helicity, you had to have a new state because it had to have opposite helicity. Okay. All right. So the plan. Any other questions before I start? That's because the plan was to, hopefully today we'll finish the kind of these kind of general quantum field theory things, the QED angle on them. So I was going to start with the microcausality argument that has the spin statistics and the antiparticles and the CPT theorem and crossing symmetry, and we'll just do the simplest example. But again, those notes that I pointed to last time have the general case. And it's also in Weinberg's volume 1. And then I wanted to do two examples where the theme of these examples are the time ordering that you have in the S matrix is dangerous. It likes to screw up Lorentz invariance. And the microcausality is one aspect of that, because if you're time ordering things, then if you can't agree on the ordering in time, if it doesn't make sense to, if different observers could disagree on the ordering in time, then they have to commute, and that kind of leads you down the road that we're going to start with. But then the second thing is going to be, when you start differentiating time-ordered stuff, the derivatives hit the time ordering, and they give you non-covariant things, because that's picking out time as opposed to space. And so those two things together are the things that are the problem that motivate the canonical approach to quantization, because the... you'll see that if you just follow your nose, then you can make things Lorentz invariant, but it looks very kludgy in the sense that you're canceling non-covariant things against one another. And the nice thing about covariant canonical quantization is that it just does all that for you. So you have a criterion, which is a symmetry criterion, which generates all these weird interactions in a way you don't have to think about. And then the point of path integrals is that they do it in an even more efficient way, because the the standard quantization eventually takes you to a Hamiltonian, and you have all these non-covariant pieces to it, and they go through and cancel other than the non-covariant pieces from the time orderings. But it'd be nice to not have to do that, given that they're going to cancel anyway. And so the path integral is a way of setting up perturbation theory where everything you get is there, and none of these cancellations are happening because you've just written the whole thing in terms of Lagrangian right from the get-go. And so I'm not going to do that in great detail. We'll see how far we get, but I want to do the concrete example of microcausality in the simplest case. The non-covariance in the case of a derivative, which is simplest conceptually, but then I want to take you through the electromagnetic field in particular, because that happens in electromagnetism. And the Coulomb interaction is the non-covariant thing that does the cancellation there. So the things we're talking about are not unphysical things. Those are really interactions that you know are there. And it's good to have the Hamiltonian version of these things, because energy is something you want to measure. So, all right, so because they're all based, you know, most of those things are hinging on time ordering, you know, the first question is why time ordering? And that goes back to the statement that we're asking these symmetries to commute with the S matrix. And it's the S matrix that is introducing the time ordering. So I want to really, I think you've all seen this derivation before, but I want to just, so we're all on the same page, to remind you why the S matrix has time ordering in it. And then we'll use that to, we'll use the expression to show these cancellations in some simple examples. So the first part is just a reminder of things I think you know already. So this is time-dependent perturbation theory. And the S matrix. And so you know, what we're trying to do is we're trying to evolve things in time. And so we know that in the Schrodinger picture, there's various pictures you can use to describe time evolution. And the one we normally start with in quantum mechanics is the Schrodinger one, where the states are satisfying, you know, the Schrodinger equation. And the operator is not evolving. And then the other one is the other natural one is the Heisenberg picture. I mean, that's the one where the states don't transform, but the operators do. And you get from one to the other by solving this one. So this says that psi as a function of time is basically e to the minus I ht psi of 0. And so if you call that, you know, u of t, then you just do a similarity transformation. If you just take everything and you use that unitary transformation to map you to a new basis, then what will happen is that you'll remove all the time dependence of the physical states, but all these operators that were time independent will now acquire a time dependence because of you. So Heisenberg picture is one where you say that the Heisenberg state would be, let's call this a Schrodinger state, is going to be given by basically U inverse, or so let's call it e to the plus I ht times the Schrodinger state. So that's designed to make it be time independent. And then all the operators in the Heisenberg picture will be given by, you know, e to the I ht Schrodinger operator, e to the minus I ht. And so now they're time dependent. And then so the complication in the evolution is all in the operators in the Heisenberg picture. So if you want to talk about field satisfying field equations, and that's telling you how things evolve, you're thinking in the Heisenberg picture where the fields as operators are evolving. But if you're thinking of how the state evolves, you're doing it in the Schrodinger picture. In the Heisenberg picture, the states don't change because they've been constructed to be time independent. And we're not going to use either of these because we're going to be doing perturbation theory. And in perturbation theory, what's useful is, you know, we know how to express the fields as a function of time in the free theory, but it's complicated to do it in the interacting theory. So we go to a basis where the operators are doing the free evolution. And so the expression of, for them as functions of creation and annihilation operators is the simple one. And the remainder of the evolution will go into the state. And so that's the one in which we're going to see the time ordering. So the interaction picture, we imagine that the Hamiltonian has got a piece we can solve and a piece we are trying to perturb in. And then we define, instead of going to the Heisenberg picture, we just do that for the, we remove the free evolution from the state. So if u naught if that's e to the minus I h naught t, so that's how you would have evolved if you had not been including the interaction, then we define our states in the interaction picture to be e to the plus I h naught t times the Schrodinger guy. And then our operators will evolve using the free evolution. And because these guys were independent of time, the whole evolution is coming from the free evolution. So creation and annihilation operators will go like e to the I omega t. Their equation of motion will be simple because they're going to be evolving in the free way. So when you write, when you expand fields in terms of creation and annihilation operators and you allow the coefficient functions to depend on time, you're normally thinking in this interaction picture because the time dependence you're putting in is the free one. And then the states are doing whatever they do. So now what we want to do is, in say scattering, is we want to take states. We start off with some initial state, we evolve it forward in time, and we want to take the overlap we imagine having, say, some particle moving in some direction. We evolve it forward in time, and we ask, what's the likelihood it comes out in some other direction? So we're interested in how these states evolve in the interaction picture. And so at late times, the way I'm setting this up, I'm taking t equals 0 to be the time where all these pictures are agreeing with one another. So if I'm going to do that, I might as well choose the initial time where I set up my experiment to be not 0, because they may not be the same time. Actually, I'm going to want to do that. Let me just think about that for a sec. Yeah, no, let's just, the picture change, I'm going to leave it the way it was, sorry. This evolution, so if I take in the interaction picture and I ask, how does the state evolve? It's going to be evolving according to, we can just figure out what it, from the definitions, how it evolves, right? It's e to the I h naught t times the Schrodinger state, which is a function of t. And the Schrodinger state, we know how it evolves. It goes to e to the minus I h t times the Schrodinger state at some earlier time, so t minus t naught times psi of t naught. So if I ask the problem is at this side, I've got the Schrodinger picture state, and here I'm interested in the interaction picture states. Let me take this back to the interaction picture. So we have e to the I h naught t, e to the minus I h t minus t naught, e to the minus I h naught t, psi of t naught in the interaction picture. This is the guy which is the full evolution operator in the interaction picture. And so this is the guy we want to solve for. And this is the guy which, if I take t naught to minus infinity, and t to infinity becomes the S matrix. And so let's call this U of t and t naught in the interaction picture. I guess I'm never going to use this again, so let's not call this U. Let's just always use U for the interaction picture. And so the perturbation story is about the derivation for how this thing looks as a function of the interaction that's responsible for the complicated evolution. And so the way you solve for that is you set up a differential equation for it. So du dt, just from its definition, is going to be, the t's are here, right? So I'll get an I h naught times u again. I'll write everything. E to the I h naught t, e to the minus I h t minus t naught, e to the minus I h naught t. So I've differentiated that guy. I now have to add that guy. But I've got to make sure I don't commute people by each other, because h doesn't have to commute with h naught. So I'll have minus I e to the I h naught t. H e to the minus I h t minus t naught e to the minus I h naught t. And then I want to have differentiate this last guy. I'm going to get minus I all these guys again times h naught. And if I've done this right, I didn't do it right. I wanted to have this in terms of the time t naught. So this guy here should have been an e to the I t naught. So I should not have differentiated this last guy because I'm differentiating with t, not t naught. So now what I've got is it's almost h minus h naught that's appearing, except that this e to the I h naught t is in the way. So I can put this h on this side because h naught commutes with this. And so we can write this as I'll move over to the next board in a sec, but I want to just finish this equation. So we got I e to the I h naught t. I'll do minus I h minus h naught e to the I h t minus t naught e to the minus I h naught t naught. And so if I put in here e to the minus I h naught t e to the plus I h naught t, then this will be our thing u again. And so I can write this as being minus I v of t times u of t t naught, where v is just given by e to the I h naught t. There's bells going off. What's that telling me? Yeah.
That's so much longer. I think it's
just, oh, just people. Okay, let me just. One thing I can do is I can mute my own phone, so at least that's not adding to the confusion.
I think there should be a negative sign.
Let me finish writing and then I'll come back to that. Just so here we'll have H interaction e to the minus I h naught t. Sorry, and then you're going to say what? Which?
There should be a negative sign exponential where you have t minus t.
Here, thank you. Yeah, that's right. Thanks. You know, ever since I'm a graduate student, whenever someone makes a good point like that about the board, because it's important to get the board right because people are following it, is the tradition is always to give the lowest coin in my pocket to whoever did it. But I don't carry any cash anymore. So I could give you my phone or my credit card or something and it gets to... And I used to do that because Wheeler used to do that. So, you know, and the thing is, you'd ask, and the reason he did it was that you're trying to encourage people to correct mistakes on the board because everybody benefits from that. And there's it's natural to not want to do that because you don't want to say that I'm kind of drawing attention to myself kind of thing. So I appreciate you doing that. But I don't have any coins to give you. All right, anyway, so the bottom line is, we've derived this differential equation for u, and then now we just solve it iteratively. So we're trying to solve, you know, du dt is equal to minus I v of t u of t t naught, with the initial condition that u of t naught is equal to 1. And you know what all this is a special case of going to the interaction picture, right? Which I've written up there. All we're doing, v of t is just the interaction Hamiltonian in the interaction picture. So that's the original interaction Hamiltonian needn't depend on time, but this new one will because of this evolution of h naught. And so so now you just solve this by, you know, plugging it back into it. So we start off with a solution 1, and then perturbatively, you know, this says that u, I just integrate, you know, it says that u of t t naught will be minus I integral from t naught to t dt1 of v of t1 u of t1 t naught. Then we, one minus that. then we just integrate again and again and again, and then you generate the series that it's sum n equals 0 to infinity of minus I to the n integral from t naught to t dt1 integral t naught to t1 dt2 integral to t naught to t to the n minus 1 dtn of v of t1 v of t2 v of tn. And then the observation is, because we're down the road, we're going to want to think of, we're going to think of this Hamiltonian as being an integral over space of something. And so these integrals of time will combine with the integrals over space in H. So if we write H interaction as being integral d3x of a Hamiltonian density, which, you know, I made the case last time that locality is telling us we want to do that, then these integrals dt's are going to combine with the integral dx's to give us integral d4x's. And now we'll have interaction Hamiltonian densities here. I won't write the interaction thing here. I'll just, it's always going to be the interaction thing. And this is the interaction Picton version of it, right? So this x really is space and time. This, in principle, this wouldn't have depended on time. It would have been a function of x. But in the interaction picture, you know, v of t now will be integral of d3x of, this would be the Schrodinger picture operator of h in the interaction picture of x and t. And I won't write that. So the guy I'm always talking about is the interaction picture guy. And then what's inconvenient about this is that although the lower limits are t naught, and we're going to take at some point for the S matrix, we're going to define it to be, you know, u of infinity minus infinity. So we're going to take that to minus infinity. The upper limit will go to infinity, but these ones are nested, and that's that's inconvenient. And so there's a standard trick which allows you to rewrite this as a time-ordered product. So it's m n equals 0 infinity of minus I to the n. You divide by n factorial so you don't overcount, of t naught to t dt1 t naught to t dtn of the time-ordered product of h of x1 xn, where the time-ordered product of two things, a of t1, b of t2, is, let me write this in the next board maybe.
Maybe it's better again to write
d4x. Yeah. Oh, thank you. Yeah. And then the time order product of a of x, b of y is just by definition step function for x naught minus y naught times. So you just want, it's just the order, if x is, what we wanted here was we wanted, the guys on the left are always later than the guys on the right, right? Because x2 is getting integrated up to x1. So this should be latest. So this should be a of x, b of y. And if it's the other way around, right, b of y, a of x, where the theta is just a step function. If x is positive and 0, if x is negative. So this is the thing. So the bottom line is that if we define S to be u of infinity minus infinity, then we have this famous formula that it's n equals 0 to infinity of minus I to the n over n factorial. And now the integrals are going all over all of space-time, basically. So it's playing an important role, because it's describing the evolution for long times, and we're asking it to be the thing that's Lorentz, committing with Lorentz transformations. So, and it's this time ordering, which is the subtle thing. And there's two levels of subtlety, one of which we talked about last time. So there's two subtleties. So how is T defined if we cannot agree on the ordering on whether X naught is bigger than Y naught? That's subtlety one. And the second subtlety is if I take the derivatives of time orderings. So if I let's just take say A, B, and a bunch of other operators, and that'll be the time order of the derivatives. So d mu A, B plus time order of A d mu B. But it also will involve the differentiation of these step functions. So there'll be delta of mu 0, delta of x 0 minus y 0 of a, b. And so you can imagine that a's and b's are going to be scalar fields. So their derivatives will transform like vectors. They'll be all very covariant. But this looks very non-covariant because it's a derivative. Only the time derivative cares about the ordering in time. And so different observers have different times. And so both these things are threats to Lorentz invariance, or to having Lorentz transformations commute with S. In addition to the problem of how H transforms. So the simplest situation would be that we would ask, you might have thought that because D4X is a Lorentz invariant thing, and the limits of integration are Lorentz invariant. The point of the time ordering was we made that look very covariant. So you might have thought that if we have made, this integral will be Lorentz invariant if these H's transform like Lorentz scalars. That would be a sufficient condition for these integrals to be Lorentz invariant. And so independent of this time ordering issue, a sufficient condition for S to be Lorentz covariant would be to commute with Lorentz transformations would be have these H's be Lorentz scalars. But these subtleties are saying that even if that's true, then the time ordering is going to try and thwart the Lorentz invariance of S unless you do special things. And that's kind of the special things are the point of what you have to do in relativistic quantum field theory to make things be Lorentz invariant. And what will happen in general is we're going to see that this condition is let's do with that first. So the problem with point one is that the space-like separated observers do not agree whether, or they say need not agree. Depends on the observer. X naught greater than Y naught. So some observers can think that some points are if I have two points in space-time outside the light cone, so I take this point and this point, there will be an observer for which those are simultaneous points. There'll be other observers for which, this one is earlier than this one, and there'll be other observers for which, like this one, that where this one's before that one. And so if we want this to be Lorentz invariant, it has to be true that when they can disagree on the times for these various operators, it shouldn't matter what the order is. So that means we have to require that h of x1 and h of x2, they should commute with each other if x1 minus x2 squared is positive. So that's space-like, unless you're crazy and use the wrong metric. That's the first thing, and that has a lot of juice in it. And then even after we have that work, when we go back to this, you'll see that what's going to happen is that in some situations, derivatives won't come up. It's telling you that I'm getting mail. Let's just get rid of the mailer.
from you.
Let me just turn all these browse all these things off. Don't turn Zoom off. Yeah, the rest of it, I think we're okay. That's what it was. So what'll happen with point two, and that'll be kind of I'll quickly deal with this, and then I think this before we get to lunch, I hope to deal with this one too. And the upshot of this one will be that, you know, H will not be a Lorentz scalar. It'll be a Lorentz scalar plus things that are not Lorentz covariant. And those non-Lorentz covariant things will go through and they'll cancel these things in a way which is looks crazy. And you never would have tried to do that if you didn't believe Lorentz invariance was true for other reasons. It would look like it was never going to be true. And so that's kind of where the morning's, where hopefully we'll get through all that this morning. Any questions about where we're going here? All right. So, you know, the story last time was we're building H. That's supposed to be built out of products of the fields. You know, we originally quantum field theory is being set up in terms of creation and destruction operators, where these create states with momentum and perhaps spin. And you know, we have a very specific algebra of operators where the A's are destroying particles, the A stars are creating particles, and it's just based on the harmonic oscillator statement that harmonic oscillators have energies that are spaced evenly, and if I have non-interacting particles and I have one particle, two particles, three particles, four particles, five particles, those are evenly spaced because they each cost a fixed amount of energy. So that connection is what sets up the existence of these operators for non-interacting theories. And so I could have sworn I solved my problem over there, but apparently not. I know how to solve it. We'll just turn the sound off here. Because I think they're speaking through the roof, right? That's Liam was the voice of God, so. So I'll turn the laptop speaker off. All right. So the story last time was this is what you're led to start off with when you're thinking about fields to start, or particle interaction, describing the quantum mechanics where you're changing the number of particles. These were the natural operators to explain things, and these were a basis of operators. You could take any Hamiltonian and build them out of these guys. And that was a convenient thing because you could build in cluster decomposition or the factorization of probability amplitudes and position if you made your Hamiltonian out of the position-dependent versions of these fields. So you Fourier transform them. So you build this as a function of fields that are defined at a position in time, and possibly their complex conjugates, possibly their derivatives, where A in position space was the integral d3p, and then there were some conventional factors. And then I went through the story which about representations of the Lorentz group, which told you that there was a square root of twice the energy here, where the energy for these states is just the square root of p squared plus m squared in a relativistic theory. And then there was an e to the I p dot x. And if we're doing this in Schrodinger picture, there would be no time. We'd have, you know, say A of P and sigma. And we'd sum over sigma. And then there'd be some function. Well, let me erase this. Some function U of P, U of P and sigma. And if I had some complicated field, maybe I had a vector field or something else, I could have some indices here. And this thing would have had some indices. And there, it was a Clebsch-Gordan problem. We knew how these things transformed into Lorentz transformations. We knew how these things transformed into Lorentz transformations. They transformed differently because we had a finite number of these. And so those transformations were finite dimensional and unitary, the representations were. Whereas these ones were necessarily represented by unitary transformations because they were acting on states in the Hilbert space. And so those had to be infinite dimensional, and the infinite dimensions are labeled by the momenta. There's a continuous variable there. And so this makes sense under Lorentz transformations if these have specific properties, and it basically uniquely determined them up to normalization. And then the normalization I chose to be, it always has this factor. And then if it's a scalar field, then this is one. But if it was a vector field, this was P mu if it was a massive particle. And there's basically a rule for getting this. If you know the spin of the particle, you know how the field transforms, you know what this is. It doesn't always exist, so there's only some fields that can represent some particles, blah, blah, blah. Let me just work through the example of a scalar field where I don't have to talk about that.
Sure. So when we were doing that, so why were we considering only the A and not the creation? Because, you know, there would also be, and if you write a field, there would also be a term with, like, a creation operator as well.
That's one of the purposes.
That's what I'm, so the point of this morning will be deriving why you have to do that.
Okay, so like here in the last week, you just said that, okay, suppose that we can neglect these and now you're gonna show why it doesn't work.
Yeah, because I'm not telling you you can't do that, but in this language, if you wanted to write what you would normally write, where you had a plus complex conjugate, then that just means your rule here is you're always gonna write A plus A star. But so that's included in this discussion I'm giving you, but I'm going to tell you now why you have to do that. You have no option to do it more generally, which you did in non-relativistic quantum mechanics. You could have done this. This could have been you would have actually done this if you were doing Schrodinger quantum field theory. This field, this would have been the Schrodinger field, and it would not have had an antiparticle. It would not have had a complex conjugate part. You would have just kept it by itself.
Okay.
And so the question is, why did that work in non-relativistic physics, and why shouldn't it also work in relativistic physics? And the reason is that if you don't do what you said, you can't get this to work. That's where I'm going. Right, and then A star will be the complex conjugate. And the thing is that we know what these A's and A stars do, right? We know that AP sigma with A star Q lambda, if these are bosons, they will commute. So delta P minus Q, delta sigma lambda. And if they're fermions, they'll anti-commute. So I'll just write this as a plus, a minus plus. That's the commutator, and this is the anti-commutator, just because I want to handle them both. And one of the things we're going to find is that what you do here for your field and what you do here for your spin is going to be correlated with what you do here for your statistics. That's part of where we're going. Good. So because we know this, we know everything there is to know about what these A's do. And so if we want, we can ask, do these A's commute or anti-commute with each other? And what we know for sure is because of this, if we had more than one type of particle, that for the bosons, they would all commute, and the fermions, they'd all anti-commute with each other, because that's just the statement that if I take two kinds of particles acting on the ground state, so that's particle one with momentum P, particle two with momentum Q, and I've got, you know, this is an A-type particle, this is a B-type particle. If these are bosons, I want the wave function to be symmetric under the interchange of any two bosons. And so it's going to be natural to have these guys commute with one another for all the bosons and to anti-commute with one another for all the fermions. So I'm going to implicitly be doing that. And that tells me that if I have a bunch of these fields A, you know, if I take A of X and I ask what's the commutator for different different positions, I first of all, what I want to do here is here I wrote it in Schrodinger picture where there's no time, but we went to the interaction picture where there will now be a time because we're evolving everything, you know, in the interaction picture. When we do this, everybody's now going to evolve like they would have done for free particles, and so this p dot x now used to be a spatial p dot x, but once we're in the short interaction picture, we're going to get a minus I energy times time, because that's what if I take the e to the I h naught t and slap it both sides of this guy, that'll give me this time dependence, because that's the evolution of a free particle. And e here is going to be the relativistic p squared plus m squared. So it's not independent of P, so maybe I should put a subscript P on it just to distinguish it from any random energy. Good. And so now the commentator I want to look at is, you know, these H's are built of the A's. So if I try and take an H and commute it with itself at different separations, which is what I want to do up there, then that's going to involve these A's commuted with themselves at different separations as A stars. So what do we know about that? So this tells us that A of XT, I'm interested in space-like separations, so let's just do it in a frame where that's equal times. So I know that A of XT, YT, minus plus, so this depends on where what we chose here for the for this guy, that's equal to zero, because A commutes with A.
What do you mean by minus plus?
So minus means the commutator, so this times this minus that times this, and plus means the anti-commutator.
Oh yeah, right, because we could be dealing with fermions.
Right, and I want to handle them both all at once. And we know the same thing's true for if I complex conjugate them both. But because of this, the trouble will come from A of X T with A star of Y T. So that'll we can just evaluate what it is, right? It'll be sum over sigma lambda. Actually, I don't have any sigmas. If I made it a scalar, that had to be have no spin, so that's what we're doing first. We'll have an integral d3p, d3q. I'll have two factors of 2 pi, 3 halves. I'll get a 2 times the energy of p and the energy of q. And then I'll have the e to the I. I'm going to write this as a 4 vector. So I have e to the I, p dot x minus I, q dot y, where by this I mean, you know, minus p0 x0 plus p dot x. And so p0 is just the energy for p. And the same thing, so then I multiply that by I. And then this will be the analog for where I'll have y and y naught and q. And then we'll have the commutator. And so this is a delta function that does one of the integrals, and we're left with an integral d3p of 2 pi cubed times 2 times the energy. These should have been square rooted. Times so now what's happening is that p is equal to q. So I'm going to get, that means that their energies are equal, but I'm going to have e to the I p dot x minus y.
I think there's an inconsistency with the exponents of the 2 pi, because like you have like 3 and then you have 3 again when you when you take the commutator.
6. 2 pi to the power 6.
Yeah. So it should be either 3 halves and then 3 or 3 and 6.
No, here you're talking about this 3, and this 3?
No, like the 3 on the 2 pi, the 2 pi factor on the denominator.
This should have been a 3 halves, right? That's what I have over here, right? I probably erased it, yeah. Thank you. That's right. So this is just a function, right? This is something which we can just figure out what it is. And it's an important one, so that's called delta plus of x minus y. So what it is, it's a function of this vector x minus y, but it's a Lorentz invariant function of that vector because p dot x minus y, that's the Lorentz invariant thing. And d3p divided by the energy is also Lorentz invariant if you do a Lorentz transformation. So this is something which is a Lorentz invariant function of x minus y. So it can be a function. So that means that it's a function of, it's either a function of just x minus y squared. If it's a space like, if x minus y is space like, it's got to be a function of its length because it you can rotate it anywhere you want. Or it'll be a function of x minus y squared and the sine of x naught minus y naught if it's time-like. So we have to do the cases where x and y x are space-like separated will be logically different from the spaces where they're time-like separated because the Lorentz invariant things I can build from x and y are its length, which it could depend on both cases, But if it's a time-like separation, then the sign of the time component is an invariant, a Lorentz invariant, because which light cone you're in, you know, if this is x and then this is y, being in the forward light cone or the past light cone is a Lorentz invariant statement. You can't change that. Whereas you can change the ordering of times in the space-like directions. And so the answer will be, in principle, a function of the sine of x naught minus y naught and of the invariant separation. And we just get it by doing the integral. And I'll just tell you what the answer is, because it's not rocket science, right? All we have to do is, in these two cases, in the space-like case, since it's Lorentz invariant, we just choose the frame which is the easiest. So in the space-like case, we know that there's a frame for which x minus y is pure space and no time. So we'll use that. And then it's a function of the vector in three dimensions, x minus y. And so then we can just do the integral over the angles for free, because they're easy to do in the angular part of the integral. And then there's an integral over the magnitude of p, which is a little bit complicated, but it turns out to be a Bessel function. And if you go with the time-like direction, it's a very similar thing. But here, the difference is that what we do is we go to the rest frame of x minus y, because that's the simple frame in which to do things. So x minus y is purely spatial. But then p dot x minus y will depend both on the sine and on the length. And so there will be a dependence. So we're going to actually get a dependence on the sine by keeping track of that. And then again, you do the integrals the same way as before. But the counting is a little bit different because you don't get quite the same answer, but you get a very similar answer. Let me just tell you what the answer is rather than...
Time-like separation, maybe it's better to set x vectorial equals y vectorial, right?
Right. So you go to the rest frame of x minus y, right? Right. That's the one that's the simplest one, because then you just have a function of the time variable in that frame, right? All right. So the bottom line is that and these notes, again, do this integral in great detail if you want to see the details. But delta plus of z, so I'm thinking that z mu is x minus y mu. That's equal to, it's m squared. Excuse me, I'm doing this for a massive particle. 4 pi squared z k1 of z. If z squared is bigger than 0. So this is space-like separated. So z is the absolute value of z mu, z nu, a to mu nu. So z squared is, that's 1/2. So it's just the length of the vector z, free vector z. And in the time-like direction, it is m squared over 8 pi z times n1 of z plus I times the sine of z0 times j1 of z. So these are all the usual best. This is the Bessel function. This is the Neumann function. This is the other, I forget the name for it.
Newman.
What's that? No, that's this one, the Neumann function. But this is the, it's the one of imaginary argument, probably. It has a name, but I forget what it is. And again, here z is the square root of minus a to mu, z nu. So it's an explicit function, is the point. And so we can ask, is it zero for space-like separation? Then it's not, because here's the space-like separation, and it's just something. And it might pass through zero for some specific point, but it's not zero for all space-like separation. So delta plus is not equal to zero for generic space-like separation. So now we're screwed, right? Because it's... We want this to be true. We're building into these guys. They're not commuting. What do we do? And so here's the thought, and this is kind of the amazing thing, that this is the way nature works. And so imagine that everywhere, let's imagine we have two fields, A and B. So for two fields, so that's two types of particles in principle. And what we'll do is we'll build psi of x to be A of x. And everywhere we see A, we're going to write plus alpha times B star of x. And we're going to ask, can we choose an alpha in such a way and choose the properties of B relative to A in such a way as to, and we'll, such that if we build the Lagrangian out of psi or the Hamiltonian out of psi, it will commute for space-like separations. And so that, what that's going to do is we're going to ask for, we want to do the same calculation for psi and psi star to see what their commutator is at space-like separations and see if we can choose alpha in such a way to make it vanish. And the magic is that you can make it vanish, provided that alpha is at most a phase, so it has, you know, the magnitude of alpha is one, and provided that the properties of B, the function delta that you build from B is exactly the same as the function delta you built from A, which means in particular that their masses are exactly the same, and because the complex conjugates appearing here, they have to have exactly opposite charges of, if there's any charge in the problem, like electric charge that it carries. And if that's true, then if you build a Lagrangian or Hamiltonian out of psi, then it will have the property that it commutes at space-like separations, but only because of this exact pairing between these particles with the same properties. And it could be because they have to have the same mass and the opposite charge. If the charges are all zero, it could be that B is A star. B could be A. And so if you have a case where the particle involved carries no conserved charges, there's nothing wrong with having A plus A star up to a phase. And that's the thing that you were saying. That's what you do for electromagnetism. There's, you know, photons carry no charges. But if they do carry a charge, these particles will be different from one another, but they have related properties. So their statistics is the same, their spin is the same, their mass is the same, their charges are exactly opposite. And those list of properties is essentially what's going to be underlying the CPT theorem, because that says that you take particles, antiparticles, and change them, then nothing happens. All right, so let's do that, and with what we have, it's not hard to do. So what, you know, if we want psi of xt to commute with psi of yt, commute or anticommute, we want that to be zero, then we're going to have to ask these guys to have the same statistics. So we'll just imagine that's true. So if particles have same statistics, so the hard one will be psi of xy, xt, psi star of yt, minus plus. And so that's going to be, I just plug in, it's going to be, you know, it'll be A of xt, A star of yt, plus terms that are going to cancel because of this. So when I say this, what I mean is that, you know, A with B is commuting. So A of xt, B of yt, is zero, minus a plus. They're both doing the same thing. A would have done that with itself, so we're asking A and B to do the same thing with each other as they would have done with themselves. The things that will be non-zero here is when the A hits the A star and the B hits the B star, and they're going to hit them in the opposite orders. So we're going to get plus alpha squared B star of Y, B star of xt, and so I can hardly stop myself from writing this as minus or plus, just change the order here, it's minus or plus because it was a commutator or an anti-commutator. And now you can kind of see that, so this, if they have the same mass, so if MA is MB, and the same spin, so JA is JB, then this will be delta plus of x minus y. We'll have minus or plus alpha squared of delta plus of y minus x. But we know that for space-like separations, delta plus is an even function, right? So we know that delta plus of z is equal to delta plus of minus z if z squared is positive, because it's just the length of a vector. So this is really, this deltas can be factorized. And so you can kind of see that this will be zero if and only if we choose the alpha squared equals one, and we have to choose this sign. We can't use the plus sign. And they are bosons. And so that's how it's going to play out, is that the need for B is the need for an antiparticle. The cancellation works only if they have a statistics that's tied to their spin, because this symmetry property, if we did this for any spin one particle, if we did this for a vector, we would have had the same argument here, that we would have had something which is an even function. But if we do it for, if we calculate what delta plus is for a spin a half particle, then you'll see that there's a sign change there, and then it's only the plus sign that can cancel. And so it's this requirement of the cancellation which is building in the spin statistics connection. And then the fact that alpha is a phase is what's responsible for the statement that, the two statements. One statement is that it's impossible to have a relativistic quantum mechanics which does not change the number of particles. Because in non-relativistic quantum mechanics, you can do that. You can change the number of particles, but you don't have to. But here you have to, because if you have any process which destroys one particle, it has to create the antiparticle. As soon as you're relativistic, you're forced to have them, and they have the same amplitude because the relative phase is just a phase. It's not a normalization. And that's also why crossing symmetry works. The amplitude for a process where I have a particle, you know, particle and some other things goes to something else. If I, that amplitude will be equal to, I have the antiparticle and something else, call that y, coming from y. The fact that these amplitudes are related to one another is also coming from the fact that this relative thing here is just a phase, it's not a normalization. So that the rate, the amplitude for destroying the particle is the same as the amplitude for creating the antiparticle. And so that's what's responsible for crossing symmetry, which is the statement that you can take particles in the past and make them particles in the future and the amplitude doesn't change, or the initial state to the final state. And there's one, and the CPT statement is this fact that these guys are all related to each other is underlying, if we take the fact that we have antiparticles now says that there is an operation in the Hilbert space where I take the particles and I replace them and swap them with the antiparticles. That's C. We always had P and T as being the improper generators of the Lorentz group. And then the theorem is you just take these properties of how you know how everybody transforms under P and T, and you know what C does because it just takes B and switches it with A. And you can just go through and see, does it make the Hamiltonian invariant? And if the Hamiltonian is a local function of these fields, it will always be invariant because the condition for it to be invariant is the same condition for the interaction to be Lorentz invariant. And so all the things that are coming from relativistic quantum mechanics are coming from this microcausality, short version of that. I think that's, well, the other nice thing is these things cancel for space-like separations, but they don't cancel for all separations because this is not true for time-like separations. So if I take the commutator of psi of x and psi of x t, well, let me just say space-time point x with psi star of y, now it's just going to be the commutator because we're just talking about bosons and I have to do bosons. This will be equal to, let's just take alpha to be, I'm just writing this out again. It's delta plus of x minus y minus, once I've made alpha squared equals one, it's minus delta plus of y minus x. And that's what you call the commutator function, delta without a sub plus minus. And this function, by construction is zero in the space-like directions. And then for time-like directions, what happens is that these guys cancel for the same reason those guys did, but these guys add because of the sign. And so it's something which is just proportional to J1. And so it's not zero. That's not zero for time-like separations. So it's not like this is the zero operator. It's something which is zero in the space-like direction, but not otherwise. Yeah.
Yeah, just a notation question. So here you write like the, so in the lines upper to that, you write like X and Y as like the, as
vector. Yeah, I should be making those vectors.
Oh yeah, and these are like four vectors because we don't consider equal times because like this is time-like separation.
Yeah, because I was focusing on where it's doing space-like separation, so I could choose equal time. I was trying to emphasize that. And I'll probably in the future also be sloppy about whether or not I write it. And so if you see it with it together with time explicitly, then it'll always implicitly be a direction in space.
But I mean, if we just see like an X alone with without an arrow in it, we just assume it's a four vector.
Well, mostly it's context will tell you. So it's like, for example, here I went from an equation with X's and T's to something without any T's. So that kind of tells you the thing without T's is going to be a space-like, it's going to be a space-time thing. But I'll try and, you know, in principle, I should be actually careful about marking them separately. So, yeah, we're doing well for time. Good. So any questions about that? So the notes goes through and does the same thing for spin one. And all that happens for spin one is in this calculation here, when we did delta plus, we would have had also a sum over this sigma and lambda. We would have had a wave function here. We would have had a sigma and a lambda here. We would have had a u sigma. Would have had a u. If these had been vector fields, let's say. Say we had a massive vector field in one particle. So we have u mu of p sigma, u star nu of q lambda. So everything would be the same otherwise. And then this gives us the delta function that we had before of p minus q, but there's also now a delta sigma lambda. And so the p minus q thing is as we have here, but what will happen is that the sum over sigma of these spinners, of these wave functions will be something we have to figure out. And so in the spin one case, let me maybe write it here. What will happen is that the new thing that you're missing here will be that the right-hand side, the commutator of a mu of x times a nu star of y time, it's going to turn into the thing we have here, which is what I call delta plus of x minus y. Let me first write it as an integral. I have an integral sum over sigma integral d3p over 2 pi cubed times twice the energy. And then we had e to the I p dot x minus y. And then we have, I'll put the sum inside here. So we'll have, I'm going to call it pi mu nu of p. And pi mu nu of p will be the sum over sigma of u mu of p sigma, u star nu of p sigma now, because they're the same because of the delta function and the Kronecker delta will make them the same. And this is something you can calculate because you know what these things are. In the case of a massive field, these guys were, these were the three polarization vectors which were perpendicular to the momentum of the particle. So what will happen here is that this will be a tensor, which if you normalize them, the sum over the polarizations, because they're a basis of in that three-dimensional space, you know, and not in the time direction, they form a basis. Completeness will say that the sum over sigma of this dyad will be the unit matrix, but it's only the unit matrix in the space perpendicular to the momentum. That means that this has to be eta mu nu plus p nu over m squared. Because if I hit this with p mu, another way of saying what I told you was that this is a unit matrix in the space perpendicular to p. So if I hit this with p mu, I have to get zero because p dot u is zero. And that's what we found from the consistency of the Lorentz transformation properties of A and the creation and destruction operators. I've hit this with p, I get p mu, then I get p squared, which is minus m squared, and that gives me minus p mu, and that'll be zero. So that in here, I can write as, so let me just write that here as being eta mu nu plus p nu over m squared. It's a calculable thing. If you know what the spin wave functions are, you know what it is. And in this case, I can think of that as being, you know, eta mu nu plus partial mu, partial nu, probably minus partial. And then now we just do the same argument over here, word for word, blah, 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 blah. And you're going to get down here, and it'll be the same thing. We'll have a derivatives acting, but it's going to be the same argument. And so you'll see that those had to be bosons too. And what happens for fermions is that the symmetry of this derivative thing changes. And so in that argument that says x minus y is even function, for the fermions, what will happen is that there'll be a sign coming from that x minus y. And it's reliably coming just for the spin half guys. And so that's what's making the fermions all be anti-commutators. Any questions about that? So the rule so far is the way we're going to make things covariant, or a sufficient way to make things the S matrix invariant, is to have these H's, if they had been Lorentz scalars, and if they all commuted with each other, so that means that they're built out of these psi's rather than from the A's. So we have all these antiparticles and things. We could still hope that things are going to be Lorentz invariant in the S matrix. And now that's going to fail now for reason two in my list, which I might have erased. I must have erased. Thank you. Yeah, right here. Right. So now so what I want to do is in the last 20 minutes is if I had had an interaction which really was a scalar. So what's an example supposing our interaction Hamiltonian, we had a scalar field, let's say, and our interaction Hamiltonian, supposing you said that was lambda over 4 factorial psi to the fourth. Versus, let's say we have particles equal to the antiparticle. That means that B is equal to A. We take alpha to be, you can always readjust the phases of your creation and destruction operator to make alpha equal 1, so there's no loss of generality there. So what we can do is we'll in that case, if the particle and the antiparticle are the same, psi would be a real function, a real operator. And so this would be a candidate interaction Hamiltonian. And if psi is a scalar, this is a scalar. So that's an example of something which would have satisfied that the interaction Hamiltonian was a scalar. And it's important for that we're only talking about the interaction Hamiltonian here, not the free Hamiltonian, which is not a scalar. So now, if we'd just done all this, it would have worked. And so the thing I'm going to talk about here would not have been an immediate problem because the S matrix would look good. But what I'd like to do is to take instead an interaction which involves a derivative of psi. That's going to be where we're going to see this problem. So let's take an example where we have a real scalar field and we try and build a Lorentz invariant problem where we take something, I'll call it W mu times partial mu psi. Let's take that as our interaction Lagrangian. And I'll imagine W is some other field. And I'm going to just treat it like it's a classical field, just because it's not going to play any important role in what we're going to do. I'm going to focus on the psi part of the Hilbert space. But the important thing is it's going to involve the derivative of psi. And so that's where this is going to play a role. Okay, so let's start over there.
Because if you would have time length separation,
yeah,
x zero would always be greater than y zero in any other transgression.
Well, if as long as I build h out of psi, it's going to have the property that it commutes at space-like separations because psi is commuting at space-like separations, and so then it's going to go through for free. So that's going to take care of issue one. So now let's, you know, if we had that interaction Hamiltonian, our S matrix would be, you know, 1 minus I integral d4x of W mu d mu psi. And then second order, we'd have plus, you know, minus I squared over 2 integral d4x d4y of the time ordered product. I'll say W mu of x, W nu of y, time ordered product of d mu psi of x, d nu psi of y, and then da da da. And the problem is that you know, I'm going to assume that W is a vector, because that's what I would need to have this be a Lorentz scalar, if psi is a scalar. And the problem is that even if these are vectors, this is not a tensor. It looks like a tensor. If I hadn't had the time ordering there, it would have been a tensor, because I'm just differentiating fields. And so the problem there, you can kind of see, is that the claim is a time ordered product of d mu psi of x, d mu psi of y is not a tensor. It's not covariant. And the one way to see that is we knew that if we had the time order product of psi with itself, that is covariant. And so if we differentiate that, if we take d mu, you know, d, let's call this d x prime rather than y. So if I take d mu and d prime nu, so this is a d dx prime and this is d dx of the time order product of psi of x, psi of y, that's going to be, you know, if I differentiate, I have to differentiate the fields, but I have to also differentiate the step functions that are in the time ordering. And rather than going through all that, let me just write down what that is. I thought I had it ready here. Here we are.
That's like, yeah, x prime or y, and then you have like d prime.
Yeah, sorry, x prime. Thank you. So, so let me just, so I'm going to get here, this will be the time ordered product of the derivatives. And then the extra bits where I differentiate the other guys are coming, they're all going to come with delta functions, because you know, differentiate a step function, you get a delta function. And it's only the time direction that does it, so I'm always going to get these Kronecker deltas that single these guys out as being time. I'll have delta of x naught minus y naught. Then I'll have the commutator of d mu psi of x with psi of x prime. And then we'll have a similar one where the other guy is d mu of 0, delta of x naught minus y naught. Again, the commutator of psi of x, d nu of psi of x prime. And then the last one is, there's, if both derivatives hit the step function, I'm going to get delta 0 mu, delta 0 nu times the delta function of x naught minus y naught, delta prime. So this is a derivative of a delta function. And it'll be the commutator of x. And so the argument is going to be, claim is that this guy is covariant. Because if I slap that in the vacuum, this is the thing that would be the propagator, right? And the propagator, I can explicitly write it as an integral over Lorentz covariant things, Lorentz invariant things. So this is covariant. So I've got an invariant thing, which is being differentiated, so this is going to be covariant. These guys are explicitly not covariant. And this guy is the difference between them, so it can't be covariant. So that's kind of the how you're going to see that this in here isn't transforming in a Lorentz invariant way, because it's the difference between something which was covariant and things that are explicitly not covariant. But they're also local, so they're all happening at the same time. And these commutators, where the commutators are not zero, you know, these things want to commute at space-like separations, right? That's kind of how we design them. And so so that means that if there's going to be a failure to commute in here somewhere, it's going to happen when x and x prime are equal to each other. So it's going to be this non-covariant stuff is happening when x and y are the same place. And so that's exactly the kind of thing you could have fixed by shifting adding a piece here, which is like a H non-covariant, built out of the W's, say, maybe the size. But you could try and design something like that to cancel these guys, because you have a chance that, you know, this kind of a term, if I added that new term here, the H non-covariant in here, it'll be an integral over X at a specific spot. And this integral over X and Y is going to degenerate down to an integral over X because these things are happening at a specific place. And so you got a chance of making this cancellation work, and you can make it work. And since we're winding down, let me just tell you what the interaction would have been. So if we had chosen this to be plus W0, W0, both at X, right? So they're all evaluated at the position X. That interaction here would have given us we would have had plus W0, W0 in here. And then this thing is going to be, so if I do the integral, there's a step I want to do here, and that is that these guys have been designed to commute at space-like separation. These guys are going to commute at space-like separation except when nu is time. Because when nu is time, one way to think about that is that this is going to be a momentum, and the field and the momentum are not going to commute at space-like separation. They're going to give you a delta function. But I don't have to make that argument about momentum, because that's a canonical argument we haven't got to. If I just take the field and I calculate, if I just evaluate what this is for space-like separations, this one will be zero, because we chose the same field on both sides here. But this one is going to turn out to be delta nu zero times I times delta of, you know, X minus Y. Because if I, and all I'm doing is I'm going to plug in the explicit expression for psi in terms of the creation and annihilation operators for, and then I'll differentiate that and just do the integrals and do the commutators, and this is what I'm going to get. But it, you can see that this together with this does one of these integrals. And if I've done these signs right, did I want an I there? Yes, I do want the I there. So because of that, what's happening is that this integral is going to be, I'm going to erase this now. It's going to be something covariant, which I don't care. I want to go to the next board. Here, that's wrong. I want to show you why, how the cancellation is going through here. So what I'm just going to copy down here, that S is 1 minus I, the integral d4x, W mu, J mu, psi, plus W0, W0. And then this other thing became minus, because minus I squared is minus. 1 half integral d4x, d4y, W mu of X, W nu of Y, times a covariant thing, which was D mu, I guess I want to do X prime again, D nu prime of the time ordering of, there's a curly bracket, psi of X, psi of X prime. That's that guy. And then this guy's going to be zero, and I get this twice. So I'm going to get plus 2i delta mu zero, delta nu zero, times delta to the 4 of x minus y, because I've got a spatial delta times a time delta. And then there's an I. I got that I. And you see that it all works, right? The 2 takes out the 2. The I, oh, so close. Now it just works like a miracle. So then the 2 takes out the 2, the I is what you need for that I, and then the signs are such that this is plus I, that's minus I, and so, and this is picking out the time parts. And so this term is exactly canceling that term. And so it's as if you just had the, so this is, you know, as if our Hamiltonian was just the covariant thing. I threw away it's just the thing that I started off with. And it's as if the time ordering product d nu prime of the time ordered product of psi of x prime was equal to the time ordered product of the derivative. So the rule, given this cancellation, the rule is as if we had a covariant interaction and the time ordering had the property that the derivatives just went through, because the difference between this term and what we started with is zero, because what the difference was canceled the non-covariant guy and the Hamiltonian. And this star here is because that's, if sometimes you see people talking about a T star product, that's what they mean. It's the time ordering with the extra fudge that you've arranged for the cancellation of all these different derivatives acting on the step functions in the time ordering are going to cancel something in your Lagrangian, and you're not going to talk about that. So normally when you set up a problem like that, you just write the because you know this cancellation is happening, you write the covariant Hamiltonian, and you write the, which is just basically minus the Lagrangian, and you time order with the rule that you can just take derivatives past the time ordering, and it doesn't matter because that's behind the board, there's a cancellation going on that you're not going to talk about. And so the point of the afternoon is, I want to do two things this afternoon. I want to do the same calculation, but for a more realistic case. I want to take, instead of a derivative, I want to take, you know, a mu for a photon. That's what we're going to do for QED. And there's a similar story that a mu, a nu, in that case, it's kind of more obvious. A mu was not a four vector. And so if I do a mu, a nu, the time ordered product of it will not be a tensor. But you might have thought that the failure to be a tensor gauge invariance should fix that, and it doesn't. There's something that survives much like this. And there is something you can add in that case to the Hamiltonian as well. The analog of this is the Coulomb interaction divided by 2. And so that's the thing that is going through and doing the magic behind the board to make the everything turn out to be covariant. And so both those things tell you there's got to be a better way to do this. And that's why you do canonical quantization, because canonical quantization is the thing, you write down a Lagrangian, you make it Lorentz covariant because the Lagrangian is a Lorentz scalar, and then you just turn the crank, figure out what the Hamiltonian is, and it gives you the covariant stuff and all a bunch of non-covariant stuff, and it gives you exactly what you needed to go with that. The non-covariant stuff is exactly what you need to cancel all these time ordering problems. And that tells you that even that's working too hard, and so you want to have a framework for perturbation theory which just talks about the Lagrangian, it doesn't talk about Hamiltonians, and that's the path integral approach. That's where we're going. And then once we have it, we'll use it. And so the stuff about infrared divergences and things will be natural to do then. But I think we can get through all of that. We were good today. So I'm hoping that the afternoon we can do the non-covariance of the photon and then also the canonical story and at least get a good ways into canonically quantizing the electromagnetic field, which is easier than for non-abelian gauge theories, but it has a bunch of curves to it that again make you think you're working harder than you need to. Good. So see you guys at 2:30.